As you can probably tell, this topic is somewhat different from the entirety of the rest of the conference. I actually thought for Monty Python fans, a workable title would also be now for something completely different, because this is really not going to really tie into much of what you've heard previously. There's also sort of another way that this title is apropos, because previous work of mine, to the extent that people here might be aware of my work, it's mostly numerical relativity and gravitational wave data analysis and such, so this is a bit of a departure. It's a very astrophysical work that I did with Jerry Ostreicher in front of Victoria. So if over lunch people wanted to talk about, you know, things beyond this, numerical relativity or what have you, I'd be happy to. Just I'm not very good with conversing about Planck or the CMB or inflation, but otherwise I'm free to talk. So as far as the actual items that I'm going to be touching on through the talk, so I'm going to just very briefly highlight the status of various electromagnetic surveys and what they can tell us about the local, I put in quotes, pollution, local relative to what we've been talking about throughout this conference, and also relative to much of what gravitational wave science talks about, redshift less than one. So the evolution of galaxies, in particular, very massive galaxies in this redshift interval, and what implications those would have for pulsar generators that are looking for these signals, which, if all of this is unfamiliar to you, don't panic, I'll explain. This is just the highlights here. I'll talk about a recent novel, hopefully better approach that we developed for predicting the merger history, or better yet, using observations to sort of tune our predictions and our understanding for the merger history of these very massive black hole binary mergers since redshift of one. And once we have the history of the galaxy mergers, which we then can relate to black hole mergers, the obvious application then is to go ahead and calculate the gravitational waves we expect to be emitted by those systems, and say what we expect will be the likelihood of detection at given time intervals for either pulsar timing arrays, and even these systems may have some relevance for LISA, which I think more people are likely to have heard of LISA. So the laser interferometer in space, looking for somewhat higher frequency gravitational waves. I'll then talk about, there's actually been a fair amount of back and forth on this topic related to our predictions and our methods versus some other people. So I'll try and clarify to what extent our results are in tension with previous, pretty much all previous results, and yet why we still believe them nonetheless. And I'll also talk about relating our estimates to actual observational constraints at present. I'll then briefly touch on, if you look in the program, I have gravitational waves and installed satellites, something like this. So this has been relegated to a single slide to allow me to give a bit more introductory stuff, give people more of a feel for the field overall. But I will briefly touch on the cases where these galaxies merge, but the black holes don't merge. What might we be able to do scientifically in that circumstance? And then finally, I'll briefly touch on the prospects for gravitational wave detection in the very near future, as well as sort of the implications of a non-detection and what we could learn from that disastrous result. Okay, so massive black hole binaries in the context of pulsar timing arrays. So here's where I promised I would explain what all those terms meant in the first slide. So pulsar timing arrays, or I'll call them PTAs throughout, time of order 20 pulsars, and search for correlated residual time. So what we do is what the observationalists do, they go and they measure the these pulses, and they model all the parameters that they know how to model. If they're in a binary system, you know, none of these that we use are in binary systems, but you would model the orbit, you'd model the spin down of the pulsar, et cetera, et cetera. And try to remove that, and then look at what remains, the timing residual. And what we're looking for is correlations in that timing residual across different pulsars. Okay, so the signal. I think I actually say it, so let me hold off on that. The pulsar timing arrays are principally sensitive to these very massive. Let me emphasize that again, because our whole method depends on how the evolution of these very massive ones is sort of fundamentally different from other less massive galaxies. So pulsar timing arrays are going to see mergers of these very massive guys, primarily in the redshift interval 0 to 1. And you know, mergers plural is a key point here. So it's not like LIGO or LISA or essentially any other experiment where your main observable is a single source coherently zipping through and you're trying to match a template to it, et cetera. This is essentially a stochastic noise from the shockingly many massive black hole binary mergers that we think, if we understand things properly, are happening in this redshift interval. Is there a question? You can definitely resolve some level of them and remove them, but what is going to lie beneath is a stochastic signal at some point. Yeah, we can talk again. This so that is also going to depend on the model of the merger history and the statistics of the population that you have. In our context, what you just said is not the case. So there are some frequency bins where you would be dominated by a single source or some small number of sources, and you would remove that. But at some point, you do hit a stochastic signal. And I think general expectation is the first thing that's going to be seen is, while perhaps not technically a stochastic signal, you're going to be observing sort of a correlated spectral shape and strain among these different pulsars. So that's sort of the main point I'm trying to make is the approach to, it's fundamentally a different approach. You can't, the signal is not building up like a single coherent source in most frequency bins. It's just not for any of these approaches. I mean, if it is, then people are looking for these things fundamentally the wrong way, which may be true. But at present, the way we search for the signal here is we calculate the correlations of the timing residuals among different pulsars because the assumption is in a single pulsar, the signal is building up at the same rate as just the intrinsic timing noise of the pulsar. So you need the correlations to actually pull out a signal, which if you were dominated by individual sources, that would not necessarily be true. It's much more than one. So one thing to bear in mind: the higher in frequency you go, the more likely you are to become dominated by single sources. But the place where you are totally dominated sensitivity-wise is essentially 1 over the observation time, where you have many, many more sources the lower in frequency you go. So you're going to have, essentially, the detection is going to be made in a very small number of frequency bins, all of which have an enormous number of binaries merging. And I'll I'll explain why you're dominated by that as I go. So generically, we know these galaxies, or you know, our understanding of how these galaxies evolve is that they can undergo mergers, they form stars, they have mass loss through winds, et cetera, et cetera. But the key point here, again, is we're looking at these very massive ellipticals, in particular brightest cluster galaxies, but also other massive ellipticals, which are often referred to as this red and dead class of objects, meaning they're not undergoing star formation. And until fairly recently, the implication was that they're pretty much quiescent in this phase. They're not doing much at all. Many recent observational papers, and I could give, for people who are interested, I could give you, you know, an extensive list of references looking at this that say, in particular for brightest cluster galaxies, but again, also for not brightest cluster galaxies, but particularly massive ellipticals, there's strong evidence that these objects are, in fact, growing tremendously, as much as doubling in mass, and even quintupling in size in terms of if you you know, characterize the size as the half-light radius of the galaxy, let's say, while still remaining red and dead, apparently. So they don't seem to be growing. And again, bear in mind, growing here is light that we're seeing. So star formation, even though you're not adding mass to the system, you're seeing much more light. So I include that in the concept of growth. It seems that these are growing a lot despite not forming stars. So what we do is we take as an ansatz that therefore perhaps the most logical explanation for their growth is mergers. And we show that if we take that ansatz, that the entire evolution of this population is due strictly to mergers, that we can actually pretty well reproduce the evolution of this population, and I'll give more detail in the next slide, just making that simple assumption and going from there. Okay, so how do we employ that actual assumption to make some prediction? So what I call it here is constructing the binary function. So what I mean by that is the standard mass function that people will look at for a particular set of observations of some class of galaxies is going to be the number density of galaxies as a function of mass. So the differential number of galaxies between a mass m and a mass m plus dm, et cetera. And that's been known for quite some time to be really well described by what's called the Schechter function, which I'll show you in a second rather than getting ahead of myself. So it's a very simple function, and I'll show you the function momentarily. And it works really well for larger redshift galaxies, sort of regardless of the sample one takes. And it also works for a large set of galaxies, even at redshift less than one. However, once you get to redshift less than one, the Schechter function starts to not do such a fantastic job at describing things. When I refer to the Schechter function, in case anyone's not familiar, it's essentially just a power law in mass turning over into an exponential tail. So it's something, you know, a power law coming in and then turning over. These lower redshifts less than one, we start seeing sort of an extra piece. So instead of coming in as a power law and then just turning over, we see a power law coming in and then sort of this extra hump. And this extra hump seems to grow to extend to higher masses as we get closer and closer to redshift zero. The way we've chosen to model this, which is not our invention, been used elsewhere in the literature, is to just add a log Gaussian portion here. And we separate the mass function into what we call sort of the lower mass, which is somewhat ridiculous because it really is dealing with some very massive guys, but nonetheless, sort of the lower mass systems that are not contributing heavily to the pulsar timing array signal. And then I say BCG, which is, a lot of them are BCGs, but it's also just the very massive end of the mass function that is dominating what we see with the pulsar timing arrays. And so what I'm showing here, this is actually a plot from one of the papers, is this dotted line is the central value of a mass function of this form with parameters set by observations. So we take that as an initial data at redshift of 1. And what we do is we, again, take observations at between redshifts of 1 and 0. And here I'm just plotting the central of their uncertainty region in these various parameters that they choose. But nonetheless, so the red curves here are what you get using those observationally based mass functions at redshift of 2/3, redshift of 1/3, and redshift of 0. The green, on the other hand, is derived by taking the same initial data, but instead of having it all be observational based, what we do is we form this again, binary function, essentially. What we calculate is the number density, or the number, rather, of mergers between an object of mass m prime and another object of mass m double prime in some redshift interval. And again, the ansatz we take there is, in particular for these very massive guys that are close to the center of the potential, or in the center of the potential of a given cluster, that the merger rate of that is just going to be proportional to the number density of objects of mass m prime, the number density of objects of mass m double prime, and some other function, which if you look at a broad generic class of galaxies going down to lower masses, this kernel would also be a function of mass m prime and mass m double prime. But in our case, we're assuming these are all down in the center potential, so we're just randomly drawing galaxies from these two mass functions. So then the level of freedom we have remaining is a redshift, overall redshift dependence. So using this function, we can trivially turn this into source and sink terms, right? We can integrate over different mass ranges and see what are the number of galaxies or black holes, which we just use the mass of black hole, mass of stars correlation to go back and forth between these two. But the number of galaxies or black holes that are entering a given mass bin from the merger of two lower mass objects, and the number that are merging with some other object and therefore leaving that mass bin going on to higher masses. So this is the basis of these green curves, is we just set up these source and sink functions, or evolution equation if you like, and take as initial data this z of 1 curve, and then evolve to the green curves again at redshift of 2/3, 1/3, and 0. So for the mass range we care about, which is essentially from here up, it seems to, at least qualitatively, do a pretty good job. It seems to be at least a reasonable description of what's happening. Now, it's not necessarily the unique answer, but it seems to do okay. Okay, so once we have that, the obvious thing to look at is the gravitational wave signature, because now we have a catalog of mergers all from the full redshift range that we anticipate is going to dominate these pulsar timing array signals, and we can test that by pushing the upper limit of the redshift. So the way to calculate that is to just basically sum up the power of the strain of all of these merging objects. And this probability distribution is essentially just the function that we saw on the last slide, plus the intrinsic frequency evolution of a gravitational wave dominated binary. Now, there's a caveat here, and I'll go into detail with it, but just because these galaxies merge doesn't mean they're black holes merge. So there's an extra bit of physics. So now, I should probably have it's the expression is sufficiently complicated, I didn't want to put another subscript. But here we're talking about the number of black hole mergers. So there's a somewhat non-trivial way of going from the galaxy merger set to the black hole mergers, in that you have to consider the possibility that the galaxies merge, but the black holes didn't. So I'm going to go into more detail on that, but I just want to mention that here at the outset. But regardless, we have all the pieces of information we need to calculate the gravitational wave signal. And I just want to briefly emphasize a distinction. So this is a movie that the group at NASA, of which I was a part, made quite some years ago, but it gets a lot of airplay. And I want to show it because it's pretty, but I also want to show it to sort of clarify the class of sources we're looking at. So if we play this, first of all, this stuff is not gravitational waves, even though it's described like that in all the media everywhere. It's sort of the local gravity. But these red objects out here are the gravitational waves, and they get, I don't know why it's skipping like that, but they get much brighter and the object merges. So this is clearly the very final last gasp of the binary before it forms a single black hole. And this is what people are sort of generically thinking of when they think about gravitational wave sources for LIGO or LISA or what have you. This is not the picture at all for the pulsar timing arrays. So I just grabbed these things from Wikipedia. But the picture for essentially all of these sources that you should have in mind is, and these are, okay, these are very short, but basically just monochromatic, that one's really short, but just a sine wave. So you have a whole bunch of sine waves because these binaries are very far apart to the point where it's not even immediately clear that across the full band they are gravitational radiation dominated. And I'll come back to that, but I just want you to bear in mind that it's not the standard in-spiral merger ring down type sources. They appear nowhere in this problem. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's these two pieces, right? This P of Z is I have a generic freedom to put in some function of redshift to match the observations. And I should have clarified that more. Sorry. So this is essentially a degree of freedom. I can pick this to match the observations. And it turns out I actually don't need this to be a function of redshift. So what I did was I empirically explored all these different functions, but there's no term in here that would take into account star formation or anything like this. This is just the only degree of freedom in the whole problem, in the whole evolution equation, is an overall normalization. And it turns out that just by picking a number, I can get this evolution to work out pretty well. So this notation, I didn't want to get into this level of detail, but so what I'm trying to say here is BCGs are only going to merge with what I call the lower population, meaning two BCGs are not going to merge with each other. So I'm just separating things out. That's right. But that's included in here. So we're randomly drawing from the actual mass function. So there are many more low mass galaxies than BCGs. That's true. That's true. You could view it that way, or you could say, well, I can make this function have a mass dependence that represents the fact that these are. And what I'm saying is, if we looked at very broad mass range, that would be necessary. But the signal is, as it turns out, it's being totally dominated by a scenario like a BCG merging with the second brightest cluster galaxy or something like that. And that's a fairly random choice. It turns out, it works out, that seems to reproduce the observations at least. All right, so let me go quickly here, and hopefully the moderator will let me go into the question interval a bit. Okay, so now that we've clarified that, let me just show. So we want to look at the actual gravitational wave spectrum. And before jumping into pulsar timing arrays, because in talking with people, it seems people are somewhat more familiar with LISA, I want to sort of set the stage of the frequencies we're talking about. So this is the LISA, the laser interferometer in space design sensitivity for characteristic strain at a given frequency. And this upper curve is what's been referred to as ELISA. It's this redesigned thing, et cetera, et cetera. Don't need to go into the politics, but you can see sort of peak sensitivities at a bit above a millihertz. So we're not talking about this frequency region. What we're talking about is lower frequencies, and one point I want to emphasize is this part here, this lower frequency part, isn't some fundamental, and this straight line saying we're not sensitive to anything below 3 × 10⁻⁵, is really just sort of like on these old style maps of there be dragons. It's really because we don't know the nature of these very low frequency noises in the solar system. So to be conservative, we just sort of lop things off. But the best case scenario you could imagine is that you just continue having the same power law acceleration noises, little bumps on the test masses, all the way down to 1/1 the observation time. That would be the sort of the dream. And if you do that, you come back all the way into this sort of this upper range of the pulsar timing array sensitivity, which is what these are. So this is both for a 5-year observation. This is roughly the current sensitivity of instruments. And this is anticipating that the square kilometer array sees the hundreds of pulsars that will be good timers that they expect to find. That's not super important, but this reference line is 1/1 year. The reason I put this here is because every constraint you will ever read quotes the characteristic strain at 1/1 year. Okay, so now let's put some signals on here. So the green curve here is the estimate from previous literature, and they've been done actually several different ways, and they all come up with sort of broadly consistent answers, either based on populating Millennium simulation halos with black holes and tabulating those mergers. Very recently, looking at combining the mass function with the parafraction of galaxies. And they all seem to work out to be pretty consistent. And then up here is our result. This is just the mean of a distribution, obviously. But as you can see, it's you know, drastically higher over here. And these are truncated where they are unambiguously no longer stochastic, which is related to the point Latham was making. There's no question that they're not stochastic above there. You can see that transition is very different here. But for the purpose of pulsar timing arrays, really, again, all that matters is this lowest frequency bit. The reason being, you can see the sensitivity is by far the best at 1/1 the observation time, and the signal is by far the strongest at 1/1 the observation time. So you're really always dominated by what's going on back there. And back there, the stochastic assumption is the safest that it is anywhere across the band. But again, these have broad uncertainty intervals. So here I plot, I think for whatever reason, this is the 2 sigma line. But regardless, you can see there's quite a large uncertainty range in this characteristic strain level. That brings us down below the mean estimate of previous predictions. And also, this is a particular functional fit that we have in the paper, but to a particular one of the Monte Carlo realizations we do. And you can see, far from being flat after the -2/3, or even this somewhat more exotic fit chosen in previous literature, there's this non-trivial behavior at low frequency that I really want to get to and elaborate on. But regardless, using various ways of translating this more messy actual spectra to an f⁻²⁰ type spectra, you see the 3 sigma lower limit between us and sort of a representative result elsewhere differs by this factor of, you know, 3, two and change. which differs the same by the same amount as the current best limit of NanoGrav, which is the US-based pulsar timing array, and an upcoming constraint quoted by the Parkes pulsar timing array, which is significantly lower. But as you can see, it's not low enough to totally wipe out the full range of predictions that either of us have. And I'll talk a bit about why, even if it did, it's an apples to orange comparison. Okay, so I'll try to zip through this quickly. Well, why did we differ with that other representative thing? So we assume that these mergers dominate, as I said, and we evolve the mass function numerically. This more recent alternative approach by Cesana, which I think is the best approach, and I'll explain why, these two approaches are sort of the best way of going at this problem rather than using something like the Millennium simulation, and I'll explain why. So Cesana, in his more recent approach, uses the mass function and the pair fraction and doesn't evolve, right? So you can either use the mass function and make some ansatz about the appearance of this binary function that I talked about, or you can just look at the observed pair fraction, which is essentially just looking at the properties of satellite galaxies around a given brightest cluster galaxy or any galaxy, if you like. So he uses those two pieces of information. But if you use all of it, if you do the evolution and use the pair fraction, you can overdetermine the system. And if you try to evolve Cesana mass function using the merger rate, it isn't self-consistent. You don't come to the same result as you do with the pair fraction. The implication being that, and this is in Cesana's paper, so I just want to point this out. You require that either galaxies only grow by about less than 50% through mergers since EF1, which is perfectly possible. Again, more recent results seem to be pushing that number up ever higher. But this is much more typical of results around, say, 2011, which are old now in this game. There's been a lot of development. But you also have to assume star formation is not negligible, because you still need to build up more mass, and you need to distribute it in a way that mergers don't distribute it. So you need a star formation term in there. Now, one big point to make is the less massive galaxies are certainly not merger driven. There's no question star formation becomes important at some mass as you go down. And exactly where this transition occurs isn't totally unambiguous. So if it occurs at high enough mass, then our result is going to be questionable for those lower mass systems, right? If those lower mass systems are important in the signal, then we overestimate the signal. It turns out that the range of masses that dominate the signal are slightly higher in our model than they are in Cesana's. And if we use Cesana's, then our ansatz would be questionable. So it's a little fuzzy and a little concerning that all these very subtle details matter. Why do we differ part two? Well, the mass, this is a trivial one. The mass density of black holes isn't well constrained. We chose a particular, and I don't need to go, this is sort of gory detail, but we use a particular value from a particular paper and correct it from another particular paper. And this is a plot from Cesana's paper, but basically it's these blue lines from a paper by Hopkins corrected by this revised correlation function. So we just choose it to be constant between Z0 and Z1 with this uncertainty bar. Cesana has a different way, so he has all these observations, but then he has various arguments why the uncertainty should be even larger. So this is an easy way for him to get a lower estimate, a lower limit. So that's an obvious place to differ. Okay, that's fine, but Cesana qualitatively agrees much better with everybody else than we do. So that's clearly something we need to address. We can sort of divide this into galaxy merger rate differences and black hole merger rate differences. So again, earlier papers favored a more modest mass growth for these BCGs, though still calling them red and dead. More recently, we think that this mass growth is more substantial than maybe previously thought, again, for these very massive galaxies, the poster child being brightest cluster galaxies. Now, as far as the black hole merger rate differences, every other estimate, really, I shouldn't say uses the Millennium Simulation, but uses something like the Millennium Simulation. Uses some n-body dark matter simulation, populates it with black holes using a dark matter black hole correlation, and goes from there. So these, even if they include some semi-analytic baryonic physics, they don't include that mass. And it turns out that that can be very important. So if you want to look at the rate, the difference in the dynamical friction rate, which this is telling you, okay, these galaxies merged, but will the black holes and whatever they brought with them merge, you know, cycle down to the center common potential in a Hubble time? Because if they won't, then they're not interesting for gravitational waves. Well, you can, on sort of a single page of paper, work out that generically this rate, which is inversely proportional to the dynamical friction timescale, is related to a term like this, 1 plus mass fraction of baryons to dark matter to some power, where this power depends on the functional form you're picking for the density. Okay, if we pick a particular functional form, so the NFW profile, then it turns out this power is 9. And if we say, well, let's assume that the satellite that's coming in has about as much mass and baryons as dark matter, then the difference in rates we get is 500. I mean, this is an enormous number, right? Now, you might say, well, this is contrived. I mean, there's so much more dark matter than baryons. But something to bear in mind is the satellite that's coming in is going to have some level of tidal stripping, okay? So this is just a repeat of the preceding slide, but looking at these plots, you see where these areas are circled. Once you get in to, you know, several kiloparsec level, you become baryon dominated as far as the overall mass. So depending on exactly how much tidal stripping goes on with the satellite, it is plausible that the mass of the baryons is at least non-negligible compared to the dark matter. So including them really can have a huge effect on how many of those merging galaxies lead to black hole mergers. So our approach sort of automatically takes this into account, whereas previous approaches, you know, clearly can't. So I have to go a bit quickly. Okay, great. So baryons can make a big difference, but I want to, beyond that, really the whole picture of dynamical friction that we use is different. Why, right? Why would we deviate from what everybody else uses for the last decade? Well, it turns out that if you sort of dig back in the literature to this, truly it's a fantastic paper. It has lots of really great material in it. But one piece that I didn't really understand, because again, this was new to me and I'm sort of trying to rederive things, et cetera, is the dynamical friction timescale. So what they do, both of us do, is we start with an expression for dynamical friction, which, just to step back a second in case anyone is unclear, probably 90% are clear, but by dynamical friction, I mean the black hole and whatever material it's carrying with it is going through the host galaxy and it's gravitationally focusing material behind it as it passes, which is putting a drag on it, sort of like a Formula One racer shooting its parachute out. And that's allowing it to sort of migrate slowly in toward the center. So starting with just a textbook expression, literally textbook Binney and Tremaine, we sort of diverge here. So what the previous people have done is taken a lot of these somewhat messy parameters, sort of difficult to have a first principles expectation for the parameters. Well, they set them to what they feel are reasonable constants, to the point where the expression they end up with, and I don't want you to read all this, but the expression they end up with only depends on this P parameter, which is the mass ratio, the mass of the satellite compared to the mass of the host. So there's no overall mass dependence here. Well, what I did was said, okay, well, now we have lots of observational fits and such to the parameters that come into this, like the half-light radius and the velocity dispersion. So what if we take those observational fits and we plug them in here? And what I found was there's a very non-negligible dependence on the host mass, which if you step back for a minute and think about it, it's really sort of shocking if that didn't turn out to be the case. If if these systems were similar to gravitational radiation dominated systems, which are invariant over overall mass rescalings, given that this is, you know, messy gas physics and there's lots of scales that come up, so why would the overall mass scale wash out? So at least what we use, it doesn't. So that's another reason. Okay. Sorry, has who calibrated there? So to the extent that the Millennium simulation has been sort of made to agree with sets of simulations, yeah, but I mean, they haven't done any extra. They just truly take the Millennium simulation merging halos, populate them with black holes, and either assume they merge no matter what, or sort of adding a bit of sophistication, have put in some sort of dynamical friction prescription. But when they do, it's this. So, yeah. I agree with the face you made. So why do we differ with the spectrum at low frequencies? Well, that was for the galaxies. So we had, okay, this is our catalog of galaxies that come together. But then to translate that into black hole merger function, we had to take into account the dynamical friction. So we take each of those pairs, and we determine if they're going to come together through dynamical friction to the point where some other process can take over, and I'm going to get to that, the last parsec problem, and make them emit gravitational waves. Okay, so the non-trivial behavior, which I just alluded to, at these low frequencies is a result of what's been called the last parsec problem, which is even if dynamical friction can get you together in less than a Hubble time, it's pretty well established that it can't be sufficiently efficient to bring you down to sort of the thousandth of a parsec level that you need to get to in order for gravitational waves to merge you in a Hubble time or less. So you need something else to take over. So what we've assumed is that stellar scattering takes over, so stars are scattering in and drawing angular momentum away from the system as they go back out. And if you do that, and I'm terrible with references, I think this is Quinlan 95, something like that, but if you do that, then you can straightforwardly calculate the frequency at which the efficiency of this process equals the efficiency of gravitational waves. So that tells you the sort of the minimum at which you might hope to begin following this F to the minus 2/3 spectrum. Okay. So at least in a sizable number of our Monte Carlo simulations, this number, this frequency, comes into the pulsar timing array band, especially when we're talking about, so this is a very extreme example that I picked out of the Monte Carlos, but especially if you go back to 1 over 20 years, this really starts happening frequently. There's two sides to this picture. One is, well, great, maybe we'll measure this and we'll get some information about the way the last parsec problem is solved. The problem is, as I was answering Latham, as far as detecting this, you're really dominated by what's going on at this lowest frequency. So if I start drawing away power at the lowest frequency, then I'm no longer accruing SNR at the same rate that I thought I was. Other people, just again to tie to other work, other people have either assumed that the minimum is always below 1 over the observation time, which is, I think, actually a really bad thing to do. You actually end up with a sort of upsweep going to lower frequencies, which is totally artificial just because that's artificial. Or more reasonably, they've put in, you know, gas drag. This is Sisana and Kosius, and as a way to sort of bridge this last parsec problem. And they similarly find that it's depleting power at below frequency of 1 over a year. So what's always done is calculate the constraint, and it's dominated by over here, and then you extrapolate it to 1/1 year, assuming that it follows an f^-2/3 spectrum. So I think this is a dangerous thing to do, and it makes it really hard to interpret the observed observational constraints and relating them to these theoretical predictions. Okay, and therefore it makes it hard to answer this question, which is, when will we be in tension with these observations? Okay, well, it depends. This non-trivial behavior, it's unclear how to convert that non-trivial, so the high frequency deviation from f^-2/3 due to the resolvable sources that Latham mentioned, that's actually irrelevant for detection because you really don't see that higher frequency stuff first, at least. You don't see that for a long time. First, you see this lowest frequency content. But if you have this dip, then it's no longer the case that you're most sensitive to 1/observation time. The 1/observation time bit is really great because then as you observe longer, you build up SNR as square root of time in a given frequency bin, but then you move back to a more sensitive frequency bin and your signal gets stronger at that more sensitive frequency bin. So if you put in all the factors, it works out that your sensitivity improves as time to the 13/6. Well, if you have this dip, that's no longer the case. Then you're just, whatever your loudest single frequency bin is, you just build up SNR there and grow as square root of time. So this can really bugger your estimates for when we'll be in tension here. That's what I just said. And again, all these quoted constraints in the literature assume this spectrum. So this is maybe too strong to say it's probably wrong. It'd be great, in a way, it'd be great if it's right to get a detection sooner. But in the long run, for science, doing interesting science, it wouldn't be so bad if it does deviate from this power law. And it seems that most solutions to the last parsec problem aren't thoughtful enough to shut off at 1/20 years or at 1/5 years or whatever it might be. So there's a good chance that things get less trivial. And just to make a very technical point, I've gotten a lot of emails from people, which it's, you know, it's great to know people like Storl Finney are interested in this problem. He's one in particular that's pointed this out, which is the Parkes pulsar timing array is putting out a constraint that's 3 times tighter than previous. It's the 2 × 10⁻¹⁵ that I put on the previous slide. But I want to, in addition to all these caveats, I want to mention that this constraint uses a completely different approach than all other constraints in the literature. Instead of looking at the cross-correlation as a function of angular separation of different pulsars of these residuals, they look at the autocorrelation of individual pulsars and basically the power that's seen in those individual pulsars. But in order to do that, they have to assume that they're noise dominated, which for the long history of pulsar timing arrays is perfectly fine, right? You don't expect there to be signal in there. But the autocorrelation is insensitive to signal. So if you're getting into the SNR of one type regime, you can easily imagine that this constraint can be off by a factor of 2, right, roughly. So I really think it's better, it's safer to trust constraints that are derived using the same detection the same statistic you're actually going to use to try to detect the signal. So I just want to mention that. Okay, so I'm going to zip through this. So these stall satellites, again, very quickly. So if dynamical friction doesn't bring these things together, you could have some hope for other observational signatures. So for example, these we know of these massive satellites coming in and forming dual AGNs. We've seen them, albeit at much wider separations than what we're interested in for pulsar timing arrays. But that's OK, because we're talking about the stalled satellites that don't reach the pulsar timing array band. Much more speculative is that some of these smaller satellites, if you do the statistics, if you calculate what guys stalled and how many of these stalled satellites do you expect in a given host as a function of mass, you get, you know, 1 or 2 for these very massive sources, which is broadly consistent with actually what we see with ULXs. And if you calculate the Bondi rate, Bondi luminosity for a wandering satellite black hole moving through gas, you can get it to be of order the luminosity that we see with ultraluminous X-ray sources. You can also get it to be much lower. So both of those are kind of interesting. You could either say, well, some class of ULXs are this, which M82X1 is a particularly notable example of Andrew King suggesting that that's exactly what that is. Alternatively, if the gas density around the black hole is just not enough to make it light up, that means we really have no constraint on black holes floating around in galaxies like this. So I'll skip this, but that was just a movie showing what we could see. All right, so what's next? So as Latham pointed out, it's very important to you know, focus on these individually resolvable sources and pull them out. If the spectrum is non-trivial, we want to do the inverse problem and say, okay, we've measured something, now what? And the next slide's my conclusion. We want to interact with these dual AGN hunters, since we have machinery to predict you know, where these are more likely to be found. For example, we think dual AGN should be preferentially found in more massive hosts because the dynamical friction timescale is longer. Well, if we get a null result in these pulsar timing arrays at these different timescales, initially, you would naturally think, well, the lower merger rate is the more realistic one. But at some point, if we push on further and still don't see anything, we have to start questioning our intrinsic uncertainties or our big picture uncertainties, like the solution to the last parsec problem. In conclusion, and I actually am going to zip through this very quickly because I want to just say one more thing on the next slide. sorry. I had lots of questions, so it's, anyway. So we've developed this new approach. We're off by a factor, or we differ by a factor of three. One of those factors is easy to explain based on the different assumptions of the mass density of black holes. The other factor is not so easy, and we think that it's a result of our different treatment of dynamical friction, potentially combined with the slight difference in the mass range that our method says dominates the signal. In the best case scenario, where the spectrum does keep going after the minus 2/3, our method predicts that we should have a detection as early as 2016. But the key point to take away is we really depend on the details of the last parsec problem. If it's solved too efficiently, then signal is removed at low frequency and it'll be harder to see. If it's too inefficient, then nobody gets into the gravitational wave dominated regime and there's a null result. So, and then I'm going to put all these up and just say, how does this relate to cosmology? Well, it doesn't really. Pulsar timing arrays are only sensitive to these low redshifts. Really, the only viable way to access cosmologically relevant masses and distances, et cetera, is to put something in space. Current models predict these low seeds at high redshifts build up and eventually form these PTA-type sources. But recent observations really sort of throw that on its head by finding these hugely massive systems at very large redshifts. So we really don't know. So LISA would tell you this full merger history of massive black holes through cosmic time. So if you want an unambiguous answer to this question, I think that's the way to go. Thank you.
Well, Neil, do you want to start setting up? Anybody but Latham to start with? Okay, if not Latham, then.
Sorry, I think I was unclear. I definitely was unclear at the beginning. It sounded like I was disagreeing with your estimates for the numbers, which I wasn't. I think that's very exciting that there's potentially a much higher estimate. The thing I was trying to say is that the traditional given an estimated population of sources that the pulsar timing array will measure, Whaley Penn and I showed in a paper last year that the traditional way of determining at what frequency the array will become confused is wrong, and then the reason is the following. So for LISA, like when at low frequencies for LISA in a given frequency resolution bin, if you go at sufficiently low frequencies, there's more than one white dwarf binary per frequency bin, and so you say that's the point at which LISA becomes confused, right. And that's right. But that's because LISA only makes one, or really technically two, measurements per frequency bin. A pulsar timing array makes n different independent measurements of the gravitational field, gravitational wave field, per frequency bin. So the criteria is not when the number of sources per frequency bin becomes greater than one, it's when it becomes greater than n. Mm-hmm. And if and at least, so I, in the previous estimates, prior to your estimates of the event rate, if you look at the event rates in like Sasana and Vecchio, at those low frequencies, even at the lowest frequencies, the number of sources per bin gets bigger than one, but not much bigger. It gets to be a few, or then at very good sensitivities 10, or at super futuristic sensitivities 100. But at comparable rates, if you consider how many pulsars you'll have in the array today, 20, or in the future 100, or in the super futuristic case of 1,000. It's always big enough that you can actually resolve those sources. So you're always actually sensitivity limited, not confusion limited. So I wasn't disputing your claims here at all. I was saying, on the contrary, the pulsar timing array will do, if you give it more sources, the pulsar timing array will do a better job of characterizing those sources than had been previously thought.
I completely agree. Yeah.